Welcome to the Deep Dive, the place where we really try to cut through the noise and give you the essential knowledge you need and fast. Today, we're tackling something pretty fundamental in education. It's about teacher freedom. What happens when teachers are given that freedom? And maybe more importantly, which kind of freedom actually makes the biggest difference?
It's a huge question.
It really is. We're diving deep into this relationship between teacher autonomy and what's called pedagogical innovation. So, you know, teachers being creative, trying new things, and we're looking at it specifically in, well, a pretty challenging and always changing field, teaching English as a foreign language, TEFL.
Right, where methods evolve so quickly.
Exactly. We kind of know intuitively that teachers need some room to breathe, some freedom to be creative, but figuring out the exact recipe for success, that's always been a bit murky, hasn't it?
Definitely. It's not always clear what type of freedom counts.
So our mission today, it's driven by some really specific and, I think, fascinating quantitative analysis. We've been digging into data from TEFL teachers. These are teachers working in language schools in Tehran, specifically the Software Language Academy branches there.
Yeah, that specific context is important.
It is. And this study is crucial because it doesn't just say, you know, autonomy is good. End of story.
Which we kind of know already.
Right. It actually dissects this idea of professional freedom into, like, measurable pieces. And it uses hard numbers to figure out which of those pieces are the real engines driving creativity and adaptability in the classroom.
Okay, so before we jump into those numbers, we probably need to get on the same page about what we mean by teacher autonomy.
Good point. Lay it out for us.
Well, basically, we're defining it as the professional freedom teachers have. And also their capacity to actually make decisions in key areas.
Like what kinds of areas?
Things like the teaching methods they use day to day,
yeah.
How much say they have in curriculum design, and importantly, their own path for professional development, their own learning.
So it's kind of the difference between just following a rigid script and being able to sort of write your own play, adapt it for your audience, your students.
That's a great analogy.
Yeah.
And that customization, that ability to adapt.
That seems key. Yeah.
It is. The research consistently shows that when teachers feel they have that agency, that power to tweak things, you see this ripple effect.
Okay. Like what?
Well, students get more involved, for one. Teacher enthusiasm tends to go up. And you see more adoption of, you know, learner-centered approaches, which for language learning is pretty essential.
Right. You need that active participation.
Definitely. Now, this particular study, the one in Tehran, it doesn't just exist on its own. It's actually built on a couple of major theoretical pillars, foundational ideas.
Okay, let's touch on those. What are they?
The first one is super influential in psychology and education, self-determination theory, SDT for short, developed by Desi and Ryan.
SDT, that's the psychological angle, isn't it? It says autonomy isn't just like a nice bonus.
Yes, exactly. SDT argues that autonomy, along with feeling competent and feeling connected to others' relatedness, these aren't just perks. They're fundamental human psychological needs.
Like needing food or water, but for your mind.
Sort of, yeah. And when that need for autonomy is met, your motivation shifts. It becomes intrinsic. You do things because you want to, because they're interesting or valuable to you.
Not just because someone told you to.
Right. And when motivation is intrinsic, SDT predicts engagement goes way up and professional development kind of happens more naturally, more effectively.
Okay, so that's the internal psychological driver. What's the second pillar?
The second one gives us more of a structural or systems view. It's the professional capital framework from Hargreaves and Fullan.
Professional capital. How does that framework see autonomy?
It sees autonomy less as just a feeling and more as a, well, a quantifiable professional resource. It's part of a blend of different types of capital that teachers possess.
Okay, what kinds of capital?
They talk about human capital. That's basically the teacher skills, knowledge, expertise. Then there's social capital, the networks they're part of, the collaboration, the trust.
Got it. Skills and networks. What's the third?
Decisional capital. And this is key. It's about the teacher's actual ability and practice in making wise judgments and decisions about teaching in complex situations. It's about having the knack for making good calls.
So autonomy fits into this framework. How?
Well, the study we're looking at uses this framework to argue that autonomy works on both levels. It's that intrinsic motivator SDT talks about, and it's a crucial part of a teacher's decisional capital, shaping their actual ability to innovate within the school system.
Okay, let's unpack this then. We've got these frameworks, SDT and professional capital, and we've got this study from Tehran. So the core question the data tries to answer is, Which specific type of freedom really pushes teachers to innovate? Is it the freedom to choose today's activity, that kind of daily decision?
The immediate stuff.
Or is it something bigger, like the freedom to choose how you grow professionally over the long haul? Does the data just confirm what we think we know, or does it maybe flip the script a bit?
That's exactly what we need to dig into. But first, to really answer that, we need to get a bit more precise about the different flavors of freedom or autonomy.
Right. Break it down.
The literature and this study often distinguishes between two main types, structural autonomy and professional autonomy.
Excellent. Structural autonomy. That sounds like it comes from the top down, from the school.
Precisely. It's the institutional setup. Think about the formal rules and policies. Does the school administration back teachers up when they try new things?
Yeah.
Do teachers have actual decision-making power over things like how their classroom is organized, what resources they can use, maybe even how students are assessed? That's all structural.
And the background research suggests that schools which offer more of this structural freedom, they tend to see more innovation, right? And teachers are happier.
Generally, yes. Studies like the one by Zhao and Waterston back that up. More structural empowerment often correlates with more innovation and better job satisfaction.
But here's a thought. What if the school says, okay, you have the freedom? That's structural autonomy, but the teacher just doesn't feel confident or skilled enough to actually use that freedom.
Ah, you've hit on the other crucial half of the equation, professional autonomy.
Okay, so what's that?
This is more internal to the teacher. It's their personal agency, their capacity, which comes from their expertise, their experience, their training, to make smart instructional choices without feeling, you know, overly constrained or pressured from outside.
So it's about confidence, skills, knowledge, feeling capable.
Exactly. And studies consistently link strong professional autonomy, not just to innovation, but also to higher job satisfaction and, importantly, better teacher retention. Teachers who feel competent and free tend to stick around. Benson's work highlights this.
Okay, let's try a scenario based on what Kira and Phillips found. Imagine a school gives teachers structural autonomy. They say, you're free to design your own lesson plans. Great.
Sounds good on paper.
But if a particular teacher hasn't had any training in, say, project-based learning, or maybe they aren't comfortable with the tech needed, they lack the professional autonomy, the actual capacity to use that structural freedom effectively.
Precisely. The structural permission slip is there, but the professional know-how isn't. So what happens?
They probably just stick to the textbook, right? The safe option.
Usually, yes.
Yeah.
The innovation doesn't materialize even though the door was technically opened. It shows you need both.
That interaction is critical then. Structural is the permission. Professional is the ability and confidence to act on it.
You got it. One without the other is often insufficient. If you only have permission, you might default to what you already know. If you have both, you're equipped and encouraged to try new things.
Which brings us neatly to the gap this specific Tehran study is trying to fill. You mentioned earlier that most research focused on things like motivation or job satisfaction.
Right. Historically, lots of studies looked at how autonomy makes teachers feel happier, more motivated, less likely to burn out. And that's important work. People like Guskey have shown that.
Oh.
But there's been less hard empirical evidence, especially in these really dynamic TFL settings, that directly connects specific types of autonomy to the actual use of innovative teaching practices.
Meaning not just how teachers feel, but what they actually do in the classroom.
Exactly. Does giving them freedom, A, lead to them using teaching strategy X more often than freedom B? This study is significant because it provides that kind of specific data. It bridges the gap between the feeling of autonomy and the measurable practice of innovation.
Okay, so before we dive into their findings, let's be crystal clear about what counts as innovation in this study. We're not talking about minor tweaks, are we?
Definitely not. The researchers defined innovation based on practices that represent a real shift away from that traditional teacher-centered lecture-style delivery. Things that change the whole dynamic.
Can you give us some concrete examples of what they measured?
Sure. One big category was flipped learning.
Okay. Explain that briefly.
Flipped learning is where students engage with the core content, maybe grammar explanations, vocabulary list, before the class, usually online.
Right. Homework first.
Kind of, yeah. Then the precious class time is freed up for active stuff, discussions, collaborative tasks, problem solving, getting feedback. It requires a major rethink of lesson structure from the teacher. That's innovation.
Makes sense. What else?
Another key indicator they looked for was project-based learning, or PBL.
Ah, yes, PBL. Very different from just doing exercises.
Very. This involves students working together, often over a longer period, to tackle complex, maybe even real-world problems or questions. The innovation here is that teachers are moving away from teaching isolated language skills.
Like just grammar rules.
Exactly, towards integrating those skills into authentic communication tasks that demand critical thinking and collaboration.
Okay, flipped learning, PBL. What about technology? That must be in there.
Oh, absolutely. Very central. The study specifically included the use of gamification, using game mechanics to increase engagement, and, very timely, the strategic integration of generative AI in teaching.
AI in the language classroom. Big topic now.
Huge. So innovation here means using tech not just for, say, basic drills,
Yeah.
but for creating personalized learning paths for students, providing more sophisticated feedback, maybe even using AI for advanced ways of assessing progress.
So these are the kinds of specific, measurable actions the study was looking for when it assessed innovative practices.
Precisely. They used a specific tool, the Innovative Teaching Practices Inventory, to capture how often teachers reported using these kinds of strategies.
Got it. Okay, let's get into the nuts and bolts of how they actually conducted the study, the methodology.
Right, so context first. It was what's called a cross-sectional quantitative design, meaning they collected data from everyone at one specific point in time, like taking a snapshot. It allows you to see associations, how things relate to each other at that moment, but not necessarily cause and effect over time.
Okay, and the participants.
They had 55 intermediate-level TFL teachers, a mix of men and women, 30 female, 25 male, and a fairly experienced group, ages ranging from 35 to 55.
All working within the same language school system in Tehran.
Yes, across various branches of the Safira Language Academy.
Now, 55. That might sound like a small number to some listeners. Was it enough?
It's a fair question. While larger samples always give you more statistical power, 55 was actually strategically chosen and deemed sufficient for the analyses they planned, particularly for detecting medium-sized effects in the regression.
And studying teachers within one institution but across different branches, that has advantages, right?
It does. It helps control for some variables. They share the same overarching institutional culture, maybe similar core curricula. But the variation between branches allows you to see if local leadership or resource differences matter, which, as we'll see, they did.
Okay, so they have the teachers. How did they measure these big abstract ideas like autonomy and innovation?
They used validated questionnaires, established tools. For autonomy, they used the Teacher Economy Scale, or TAS.
And that wasn't just one score for autonomy, was it?
No, crucially, the TAS was designed or adapted to break autonomy down into those different dimensions we need to compare. The questions were very specific. Things like, I have control over the instructional methods I use in my classroom. That targets one type of autonomy.
Versus another question like,
Versus something like, I am involved in decisions about curriculum content. That clearly taps into a different dimension.
okay, so the TAS measured the different types of freedom. What about the outcome, the innovation?
For that, they use the Innovative Teaching Practices Inventory. The ITPI. This scale directly asked teachers how frequently they use those specific strategies we just talked about: flipped learning, PBL, integrating digital tools, AI, collaborative projects, and so on.
And using these validated scales is important, right? It means we can be more confident they're actually measuring what they intended to measure.
Exactly. Reliability and validity are key in quantitative research. It avoids just measuring noise.
So this brings us to the heart of the study's design, breaking autonomy down. They didn't just ask, how much autonomy do you have? They looked at three specific facets, which became their independent variables, the things they thought might predict innovation.
Correct. Isolating these was crucial to figuring out which one packed the biggest punch.
Okay, let's name them clearly. Facet one, decision-making autonomy.
Right. Think of this as the immediate, day-to-day, in-the-classroom freedom. Can I choose my teaching methods for this lesson? Can I manage my classroom the way I see fit? Can I sequence activities today? It's the autonomy you exercise during the lesson or when planning for tomorrow.
Got it. Daily choices. Facet two, curriculum design autonomy, CDA.
This is a step higher, maybe more strategic. It's about flexibility with the actual course material. Can I adapt this unit? Can I supplement the textbook? Can I maybe even skip section or design a new one if I think it serves my students better? It's about shaping the what is taught over a longer period.
Okay, shaping the content. And facet three, professional development autonomy, PDA.
And this one is about the teacher's own learning and growth. Do I have control over which training courses or workshops I attend? Can I choose what skills I want to develop? Do I have a say in how I allocate my time or resources for my own professional learning? It's autonomy over self-improvement.
Okay, DMA, CDA, PDA, three distinct flavors of freedom. Now, before we get to big reveal, which one most strongly predicted innovation, what did the teachers themselves report about their levels of freedom in these areas, the descriptive findings?
Yeah, this initial data provides really useful context. First off, the teachers generally reported using innovative practices at a moderate to high level. The average score on the ITPI was 3.65 on a 5-point scale.
So innovation wasn't absent. These teachers were already trying things.
Exactly. But critically, their perception of autonomy varied quite a bit across those three dimensions.
Where did they feel they had the most freedom?
They reported the highest average score for decision-making autonomy, DMA. The mean was 3.95.
So nearly a 4 out of 5. That suggests they felt pretty empowered in their daily classroom management and instructional choices. Like the schools trusted them with the minute-to-minute stuff.
That seems to be the case, yeah. They felt most free in their immediate domain.
And crucially, where did they report feeling the least free?
The lowest average score was for curriculum design autonomy, CDA, with a mean of 3.70.
Still above the midpoint, but noticeably lower than DMA.
Right, and this difference is really important. Even before running the complex analysis, this descriptive data hints that teachers felt the most hemmed in, the most constrained, when it came to making substantial changes to the overall curriculum.
Likely because of things like standardized tests or maybe centrally mandated textbooks.
That would be the likely hypothesis, yes. External pressures often limit how much teachers feel they can deviate from the prescribed path.
Okay, so we've got this picture. Teachers feel pretty free in their daily teaching decisions, DMA, but less free to mess with the overall curriculum, CDA. That tension really sets the stage perfectly for the main analysis, doesn't it?
It absolutely does. It raises the question, does the freedom they have most, DMA, impact innovation more, or does the freedom they have least, CDA, or perhaps the freedom over their own learning, PDA, hold the real key?
Let's find out. Time for the hard data.
Okay, here's where it gets really interesting, as you said. We're moving now from just describing what teachers reported to looking at the results of the multiple regression analysis. This technique isolates the unique predictive power of each type of autonomy, DMA, CDA, and PDA, on that final innovation score from the ITPI.
So it tells us how much each one contributes, holding the others constant.
Exactly. It untangles their individual influence. Let's start with the big picture first. Taken together, how much of the difference in teachers' innovation scores could be explained by these three types of autonomy? Together, the three dimensions explained a statistically significant amount of the variance in innovative teaching practices. The key number here is the R squared, or Textor 2.
And what was that value?
The text 2 was $56, and this was highly significant, with a p-value less than 0.001.
Okay, text 2, let's translate that for everyone listening. What does 0.56 mean in practical terms?
It means that 56% so, more than half of the differences we see in how innovative these TFL teachers are, can be accounted for by their combined levels of decision-making, curriculum design, and professional development autonomy.
Wow, 56%, that's substantial. It confirms that autonomy isn't just a factor, it's a major driver.
A profoundly influential predictor in this context, yes.
Yeah.
It tells us these types of freedom collectively matter a great deal for whether teachers try new things.
Okay, so they matter collectively. Now for the main event, the ranking. Which type of autonomy had the biggest impact? We look at the standardized coefficients, the beta values, right? Because they let us compare the relative strength directly.
Correct.
Yeah.
The beta tells us the expected change in the innovation score in standard deviation units for a 1 standard deviation increase in that specific type of autonomy while controlling for the other types. Higher beta means stronger unique impact.
All right, let's start from the bottom. Which dimension came in last place? The weakest predictor.
Taking the bronze medal and kind of confirming what the descriptive data hinted at was curriculum design autonomy, CDA.
Okay, what was its beta value?
Its beta was 0.28. Now, it was statistically significant, p0.003, so it does have some relationship with innovation. But compared to the others, its unique predictive power was the lowest.
And the effect size. You mentioned effect sizes earlier.
Right. Using Cohen's guidelines, this beta corresponds to a small to moderate effect size, calculated as feet pound always equals 0.2 S of Tenera.
Hmm.
So a real effect, but not huge.
Interesting. So the freedom teachers reported having the least of was also the freedom that had the weakest unique link to their innovative practices. It suggests that even if they had a bit more freedom here, the impact on innovation might be limited, perhaps because of those external constraints we talked about.
That's a very plausible interpretation. If the system heavily dictates the curriculum, giving teachers a slightly more CDA might not unlock major innovation compared to other freedoms.
Okay, so CDA is third. Moving up the ranks, who got the silver medal? The second strongest predictor.
The runner-up was decision-making autonomy, DMA, the freedom in daily classroom choices.
And its numbers, beta and effect size.
DA came in with a stronger beta of 0.35, also highly significant, P0.001. This corresponds to a solid, moderate effect size, phi dollars, Duckel's door, 2/8, 2/3.
So DMA is clearly more influential than CDA?
Definitely. This confirms what many might expect, giving teachers control over how they teach their lessons day to day, how they manage activities, how they structure class time. That freedom is strongly and positively linked to them trying out more innovative approaches. It's vital.
That makes intuitive sense. If you control the how, you can experiment more easily.
Exactly. But it wasn't the winner.
Ah. So the gold medal, the number one predictor of innovative teaching practices in this study was?
Professional development autonomy, PDA.
Yeah.
Control over their own learning.
Really? PDA beat out DMA. What was its beta?
Yes, PDA had the strongest standardized coefficient by a noticeable margin. Beta was 0.42. Again, highly significant, P.00.
And the effect size for PDA?
This registered as a large effect size, $200, 355 notes. The finding is pretty clear and quite dramatic. In this group of teachers, having control over their own professional learning path was the single most powerful predictor of whether they used innovative teaching strategies.
Wow. Okay, let's pause here because this feels like the core finding. PDA beta is stronger than DMA, 1/355, which is stronger than CDA, beta equals 0/355. That's the hierarchy the data revealed.
Why? Why would the freedom to choose your own training matter even more than the freedom to choose your daily teaching methods? That seems counterintuitive for some, maybe. Administrators might think giving freedom in the classroom is the main thing.
It's a great question, and the context of TFL is likely key here. Think about how quickly things change in language teaching new technologies, new understandings of language acquisition, new methodologies appearing all the time.
True, it's very dynamic. So having decision-making autonomy, DMA, is great, but it's only as effective as the range of methods and strategies you actually know. If your professional knowledge is stuck in older methods, high DMA just means you're free to implement those older methods very efficiently.
Ah, I see. So DMA lets you to drive the car, but PDA lets you choose which car to drive, or maybe how to upgrade the engine.
That's a fantastic analogy. If you have high PDA, you're actively choosing to go learn about the latest things. Maybe take an online course on using AI for personalized feedback, or you attend a workshop on implementing task-based language teaching effectively, or you dig into research on gamification.
You're updating your toolkit.
Exactly. The autonomy to select what you learn equips you with the cutting-edge skills and knowledge needed to actually implement the kinds of innovations the study measured, like flip learning or AI integration. DMA lets you use the tools. PDA lets you acquire the best new tools.
So in a field that changes fast, like language teaching, the capacity to adapt your own practice through self-chosen learning becomes even more crucial than just the freedom to execute what you already know.
That seems to be what this data is strongly suggesting. The teacher's decision to continuously learn and upskill when they have the freedom to direct that learning is the primary engine for bringing new practices into the classroom.
And we can link this back to those theories, can't we? How does PDA connect to SDT?
Beautifully. Remember SDT's core needs: autonomy, competence, and relatedness. High PDA directly feeds the need for competence. When teachers freely choose learning opportunities that make them feel more skilled and effective, their intrinsic motivation gets a huge boost.
And that motivation leads them to?
To actually try out the new innovative strategies they just learned and feel competent in. It creates this positive upward spiral. Autonomy in learning leads to increased competence, which fuels intrinsic motivation to innovate using those new skills.
That makes a lot of sense. Let's look at those effect sizes again to really hammer home the practical difference. PDA had a large effect, value P equals star is a 355, DMA moderate, phi 5 utils 0.281, and CDA small to moderate, phi 5 utils for $200.
Right. The jump from CDA to PDA in terms of practical impact is substantial.
So if an administrator or a school leader is listening to this and they really want to see their teachers adopting more innovative practices like flipped classrooms or using digital tools effectively, what's the main takeaway from this ranking?
The data suggests their best bet, the highest leverage point, is to focus on increasing teachers' professional development autonomy, giving teachers meaningful control over their training choices, budgets, and time for learning.
That's likely to yield more innovation payoff than, say, just loosening restrictions on tweaking the existing textbook.
Based on this study, yes. Prioritizing PDA seems to be the more powerful lever for driving the adoption of modern pedagogical approaches in this context.
It really reframes how we often think about professional development, doesn't it? It's often seen as this top-down mandatory thing. You must attend this workshop.
Right, a compliance exercise.
But this data suggests PD is most potent when it's an act of self-determination by the teacher, when they identify what they need to learn and have the freedom to pursue it.
Exactly. And interestingly, that self-directed learning might often focus on acquiring skills like digital literacy or specific AI tools that actually help them work around the constraints they might face with curriculum design autonomy.
Ah, clever. So if they can't change the curriculum content?
They use their PDA to get really good at changing the how, the delivery method, using new skills and technologies they chose to learn. They might not be able to remove a grammar point mandated by the syllabus.
But they learned, through their own chosen PD, how to teach or assess that grammar point using an innovative, engaging digital game or AI tutor.
Precisely. It becomes a kind of professional workaround, enabled by PDA, that still results in measurable innovation in their teaching practice, even if the core curriculum remains fixed.
Fascinating. Okay, so we've established autonomy is key, explaining 56% of the variance, and PDA is the most important type. But what about the other 44%? What else influences whether a teacher innovates?
Right, autonomy doesn't operate in a vacuum. That's where the next layer of the analysis comes in, the path analysis. This looked at the role of the institutional context. How does the school environment itself shape the relationship between autonomy and innovation?
So it's looking at indirect effects, how the surroundings help or hinder.
Exactly. Is autonomy enough on its own, or does it need fertile ground to actually sprout innovation? The study found pretty clearly that the environment matters. Autonomy's impact is significantly mediated or shaped by external institutional factors.
An autonomous teacher in a really unsupportive or under-resourced school might still struggle to innovate then.
That's the idea. The study identified two key institutional factors that acted as significant mediators. The first one was leadership support.
Okay. Support from the principal or administrators. How significant was that?
Highly significant. The path analysis showed a beta of 0.30, P equals 0.005, for its mediating effect. What this means practically is that even if a teacher feels they have high autonomy, especially PDA, if their direct supervisor or the school leadership is actively unsupportive or just indifferent,
that innovation might just wither on the vine.
It's much less likely to flourish, yes. The analysis specifically pointed to the importance of collaborative leadership styles as opposed to just top-down management.
What does collaborative leadership look like in this context? What were they measuring?
It involves leaders who actively encourage teachers to take reasonable risks, to experiment. Leaders who don't punish failures, but see them as learning opportunities. It also means involving teachers in wider school decisions, maybe about resource allocation or scheduling PD time.
And recognizing success.
Crucially, yes. Leaders who publicly acknowledge and maybe even reward teachers who successfully try out things like PBL or new tech tools. That sends a powerful message that innovation is valued, which makes teachers more likely to use the autonomy they have.
Okay, so supportive collaborative leadership is one key mediator. What was the second?
The second was resource availability.
Makes sense. You need the tools for the job. How strong was its effect?
Also a significant mediating factor, with a beta of 0.27, P equals 0.007. This covers the physical and digital infrastructure. You can give a teacher all the autonomy in the world to try flipped learning.
But if students lack reliable internet at home, or the classroom doesn't have a functioning projector or decent Wi-Fi,
then the autonomy is basically useless for that specific innovation. Having access to up-to-date materials, digital tools, interactive whiteboards, necessary software licenses, this resource base is essential for autonomy to translate into many forms of modern innovation.
The study actually used data comparing different branches of the same language academy, right? Did that illustrate this point about context?
Yes, beautifully. This is where looking within the SAFR system was insightful. They found significant differences in innovation scores between branches.
Tell us about that.
Well, Branch A, for instance, had the highest average innovation score, M equals 3.9. The interpretation is that Branch A likely had that winning combination. Teachers felt autonomous, and this autonomy was amplified by strong, supportive leadership and good investment in resources.
The fertile ground.
Exactly. Conversely, Branch C had the lowest innovation score, M equals 3.4.
What might explain that lower score?
Branch C might represent a context where perhaps teachers felt some level of autonomy on paper, but significant institutional barriers existed. Maybe restrictive local policies, perhaps a lack of funding for essential digital tools, or maybe a more traditional top-down, risk-averse leadership style.
So even if a teacher in Branch C had high PDA and learned about great AI tools,
if the branch leadership didn't support trying them, or the school's IT infrastructure couldn't handle them, or there was no budget, that innovation potential just couldn't be realized. The institutional context acts like an amplifier or a muffler for teacher autonomy.
It really highlights that it's a system issue, not just about individual teachers.
Absolutely.
Let's circle back one more time to that relatively weak influence of curriculum design autonomy, CDA. We touched on why it might be low, but how does this finding compare to other research? Don't some studies find CDA really important?
Yes, some previous literature, perhaps in different educational systems or contexts, has identified CDA as a major driver. But the Tehran study's finding that it was the weakest predictor here is compelling because of the specific context.
The TFL high-stakes testing environment.
Exactly. In many such environments, there are powerful external forces, national exams, university entrance requirements, specific government curriculum mandates, maybe even the structure of widely used commercial textbooks that severely limit how much real freedom teachers have to fundamentally alter the curriculum content or sequence.
So they're basically teaching to the test or teaching to the textbook because they feel they have to.
To a significant extent, yes. Their professional judgment might tell them a different approach or different content would be better, but the external pressures make deviating feel too risky or simply impossible. They feel bound to cover a certain material in a certain way.
Which makes their perceived autonomy in this area, CDA, lower, and also makes any CDA they do have less impactful on overall innovation.
Precisely. If you can't change the what, you focus your innovative energy on the how. This aligns with findings from researchers like Borko, who noted that in highly standardized, test-driven systems, teachers often compensate by focusing their autonomy on instructional strategies and classroom management areas where they still have some control.
So the dominance of PDA in this study might be partly because CDA is so constrained. Teachers pour their energy into the freedom they can control their own learning to make a difference.
That's a very insightful way to put it. It becomes the most viable pathway for exercising their professional agency and bringing fresh approaches into a system that might be quite rigid in other respects.
Okay, this paints a really clear, nuanced picture. Let's pivot now to the so what. What are the practical takeaways from all this? What does this mean for you, the listener, whether you're a teacher, an administrator, or a policymaker?
Right. Translating the findings into actionable advice is crucial. Let's start with teachers themselves, particularly TFL teachers, but the principles likely apply more broadly.
What's the main message for them?
Given the PDA control over your own learning was the strongest predictor, the message is really empowering. Take charge of your own continuous professional development, CPD. Don't passively wait for mandatory training.
Be proactive.
Exactly. Proactively seek out opportunities that genuinely interest you and address skills you want to build. Look for online courses, workshops on emerging methods like using AI effectively. Maybe dig into research on areas you find challenging. Drive your own growth.
And collaboration plays a role too. You mentioned social capital earlier.
Absolutely. Teachers should actively form or join professional learning communities. PLCs. These aren't just casual chats. They are structured groups where educators can share what they're learning from their individual PD, discuss challenges they face, perhaps with the curriculum, and collaboratively pilot or explore new strategies. It's a way to leverage that individual PDA across a team and build collective expertise. Maybe explore a new AI platform together.
Okay, so be proactive about your own learning and collaborate with peers. What about the institutions, the school leaders, the administrators? The data gives them a clear mandate too, right? Especially regarding that enabling context.
A very clear mandate. First, they absolutely must rethink and enhance professional development. Move away from one-size-fits-all mandatory sessions.
Offer choice.
Offer meaningful choice. provide teachers with budgets or dedicated time and logistical support so they can select training that aligns with their perceived needs and professional interests. Maybe implement mentorship programs, pairing experienced innovators with those wanting to learn. Make PD teacher-driven.
And that finding about leadership support being a key mediator, what's the action point there?
It requires a shift towards promoting cooperative and supportive leadership. This means actively encouraging experimentation, celebrating successes, and framing failures as learning opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
Involve teachers in decision-making beyond their own classrooms.
And reward innovation.
Yes. Formally recognize and reward teachers who are trying new things and sharing their practice. Reduce the bureaucratic hurdles that can stifle creative initiative. Create a culture where trying something new is safe and valued.
And the resources piece, the infrastructure.
Institutions need to invest strategically in resources. This goes beyond textbooks and photocopiers. Allocate budget specifically for the kinds of technology that enable modern pedagogy, reliable high-speed internet access throughout the school, interactive whiteboards or projectors in classrooms, licenses for useful language learning apps, platforms, or AI assessment tools. Autonomy needs the right tools to be effective.
Okay, that covers teachers and institutions. What about the bigger picture? Policymakers, especially given the constraints found around curriculum design autonomy.
The findings have significant policy implications. Policymakers should seriously look at revising curriculum policies. Where possible, move away from overly rigid, standardized curricula that force teaching to the test. Explore competency-based frameworks that allow teachers more flexibility to adapt content and pacing to meet diverse student needs and integrate innovative, project-based approaches.
So, building in more room for professional judgment at the curriculum level?
Exactly. Trusting teachers more with the what's as well as the how. And another key policy point relates to quality assurance.
How so?
Accreditation bodies organizations like Cambridge Assessment, TESOL, maybe National Education Ministries, should consider integrating teacher autonomy indicators into their standards for schools or programs.
So judging schools partly on how much they empower their teachers?
Precisely. Assess whether institutions provide meaningful PDA, foster supportive leadership, and offer adequate resources. Make teacher autonomy and support a visible marker of institutional quality, not just an optional extra.
These are all strong recommendations based on the data. But as with any study, we need to be critical thinkers. What were the limitations of this specific Tehran study that we should keep in mind?
Absolutely crucial to acknowledge limitations. First, generalizability. We had 55 teachers from one specific language academy chain in one city, Tehran.
So we can't automatically assume these exact findings. The precise ranking of PDA, DMA, CDA would hold true everywhere, like in a rural public school in a different country.
Exactly. Context is king. The cultural context, the educational system, the specific pressures might be different elsewhere, potentially changing the dynamics of autonomy and innovation. More research in diverse settings is needed.
What else? The study design itself.
Yes, it was cross-sectional, that snapshot in time we mentioned. While it shows strong associations, high PDA correlates with high innovation. It can't definitively prove causation.
Meaning, we can't be 100% sure high PDA causes innovation. Could it be the other way around? Maybe highly innovative teachers naturally seek out more PDA.
That's theoretically possible, or there could be a third factor influencing both. To establish clear causality, you'd ideally need longitudinal studies that track teachers over time, measuring changes in autonomy and seeing if they precede changes in innovation.
Got it. Any other limitations?
The reliance on self-report surveys is always a potential issue. Teachers were reporting on their own autonomy and their own use of innovative practices.
And people might consciously or unconsciously present themselves in a slightly better light. Social desirability bias.
It's a possibility.
Yeah.
Teachers might overestimate how often they use innovative techniques. Future research could strengthen these findings by incorporating more objective measures, perhaps direct classroom observations, analysis of lesson plans, or even tracking usage data from digital learning platforms.
And the study touched on AI, but technology is moving so fast.
Right. The sources themselves suggest a key area for future research is to delve deeper into how these emerging technologies, AI, virtual reality, advanced gamification, are specifically interacting with teacher autonomy and mediating that link to innovation. That relationship is likely evolving as we speak.
Okay, acknowledging those limitations is important for a balanced view. Let's try to synthesize everything now. What's the core takeaway message from this deep dive?
The clearest takeaway is that teacher autonomy is not just some abstract ideal. It's a powerful, measurable driver of pedagogical innovation, at least in this TEOFL context. It explained over half the difference in how innovative teachers were.
But it's not just any autonomy. The type matters hugely.
Absolutely. The hierarchy that emerged from this data is striking. Professional development autonomy, PDA, the freedom to control your own learning, was the undisputed champion, the strongest predictor of innovative practice.
Followed by decision-making autonomy, DMA, freedom in daily teaching choices, which was also very important.
Yes, a strong second place.
And curriculum design autonomy, CDA, while still relevant, was significantly weaker, likely due to the specific constraints of the educational system studied.
Correct. And crucially, the impact of any autonomy is significantly amplified or dampened by the institutional context specifically, the level of leadership support, and the availability of necessary resources. Autonomy needs that supportive ecosystem to truly thrive.
So this research really weaves together those theoretical threads we started with. PDA boosting competence links back to self-determination theory.
Mm-hmm. Fulfilling that psychological need drives intrinsic motivation to innovate.
And the importance of leadership and resources fits perfectly with the professional capital framework, showing that individual autonomy needs to be embedded within supportive social and structural capital to be truly effective.
Exactly. It offers a really nice synthesis of the psychological and the systemic factors at play.
Okay, fascinating stuff. It really gives us a much clearer picture of what kind of freedom matters most for teachers who want to innovate. So to leave you, our listener, with something to chew on, here's a provocative thought that builds directly on these findings. We've seen that professional development autonomy, PDA, is the strongest predictor of innovation. We also know many teachers feel heavily constrained by rigid curriculum requirements, low CDA. So consider this. How much institutional support, strong leadership, ample resources would be needed to make a teacher who has low curriculum design freedom but high PDA actually more innovative and effective than a teacher who has lots of freedom to change the curriculum but gets zero institutional support?
That's a tough one. Where's the tipping point?
Right. If PDA is truly the gold medal winner, how might institutions need to change? Instead of treating professional development as this optional extracurricular thing or a top-down mandate, how could they formally build learning how to innovate, driven by teacher choice, directly into the mandated workload and schedule? Could that be the key to maximizing both teacher competence and pedagogical freedom, even within systems that have curriculum constraints?
Where does the ultimate responsibility for fostering innovation really lie? With the teacher's intrinsic drive or the institution's enabling structures?
Something to mull over. That's all for this deep dive.